Okay, I'm happy to be with you today, and for those of you who are interested, there is a handout of my PowerPoint on the back table, and the very last page of this is two stories that are part of my political action toolkit that the students receive. Unfortunately, my computer refused to turn that into a PDF file, so I was not able to upload that, but it is on the handout, and if anybody doesn't get it and wants it, you can let me know, and I will send you the file. What I'm going to be talking about is a program I helped develop when I was an associate professor at St. Catharines University in St. Paul. I formally retired at the end of the academic year in 2009, and I now have my two retirement jobs where I'm with two different universities. So I'm going to be talking about something that's part of another part of my life. I taught health policy in public health when I taught at the University of Minnesota in the School of Public Health in the 70s and 80s. So I have a long-term interest in involving nurses in political activity and collective social action. So you're going to kind of get my view of the world on that. We'll be discussing content via the learning objectives, so I won't go over them. The first part I want to just talk to you about is what I see as the essential curricular components to prepare students to actively participate in lobbying at the individual level and participating in collective social action. And so I start with the idea that you have to have total engagement of the active learner. Not all students are interested in being active learners, as you know, especially when it involves going out in the community and doing things they aren't comfortable with. But we're also looking at all three domains of nursing, because being politically active and taking on healthcare priorities does involve beliefs and values and culture and lifestyle that they bring to the nursing profession through their own individual private lives. And then the cognitive domain, there's much to learn about. I've decided nobody learns civics in high school anymore. And you don't know the difference between your state legislative districts and the national legislative districts, and don't know how to find the numbers and so forth. I'm going, okay, we're back to step one, civics from high school. So we kind of cover the waterfront. And then psychomotor, things like writing letters, making signs, dressing for success when you're going to talk to politicians and policymakers. Students need to be immersed in community and real life experiences, and we know this in public health, but I see this as almost a precursor to becoming politically active. They have to know what's going on in the community. They have to see the health disparities. They have to see the social injustice. They have to have their worldview challenged. They have to move out of their comfort zone, and they have to learn to listen to other people's point of view. I had a student, what I'm talking about is how we worked with Minnesota Nurses Association and went to MNA Nurses Day on the Hill, and I had one student who said, I can't do that. And I said, why? And she said, well, because MNA is too democratic. I thought, what does she mean by that? And finally, I got it. She meant they tended to support Democrats rather than Republicans, so she couldn't be affiliated with the association. And she did something else. We weren't able to move her out of her comfort zone. But helping them to listen to other people's point of view and helping them to learn skills of compromise, collaboration, and negotiation, which would be helpful for all of our politicians at this stage. Placement in the curriculum, I see the political process and being politically involved as a synthesis learning experience. I think that a political involvement should either be congruent with or follow the public health experience, so they have that life experience of being out there in the community. They should have a solid foundation in nurse ethics, because they're constantly confronted with ethical dilemmas when you look at health policy, health issues, health disparities, and their political involvement should involve leadership development. And what I found is most nursing students are not comfortable, especially when they're still in their nursing program, with the whole concept of being a leader and leadership development. The three areas of nursing ethics that I think need to be covered are rule ethics, virtue ethics, and feminist ethics. And I use the Volbeck model for that. Nursing leadership, I have to clarify to the students that leadership and management are very separate things. They see their supervisors as leaders. And I say, no, no, they're supervisors. And I'll say to a student, have you ever, when you've been taking care of a patient, gone and asked someone else, intervened, said this patient needs more pain medication, or this patient needs this sort of help, or this patient would like to take a walk outside, can we get an order of that? And because they're mostly in acute care, so I use that as their frame of reference. And if they say yes, I said, well, then that's the first step in leadership, because you are advocating for your patient or advocating for your client. So that's all we're doing in the political process is advocacy, but now on a larger scale for populations. I explain that because they are licensed by the state, they have a social contract with the public to provide the health services that are needed. And that, as other speakers have talked about, is part of the expectations of the professional nursing practice. And because they're going to be confronted with ethical dilemmas that they have to resolve, they need to be prepared to take the lead and to advocate. So caring leads to political advocacy. I talk to them about what nursing leadership is, again, separating it from management. And I talk to them about effective nursing leadership is transformative. So it's not all about them. It's about this process of transforming themselves and helping to transform others in the leadership followership dyad. And then effective nursing leadership is dispersed, which means we all have to be leaders, not one of us. We all work together from diverse positions. And I talked about the community of feeling, which gets into the affective domain, where if you care and you have a commitment to the same type of ethical principles and to population groups, that you'll be motivated to follow. Okay, and then I talk about power. Most nursing students and nurses from my 40 years of teaching are not comfortable with the concept of power. They see it as a negative thing. So we talk about using power for the common good, using power to empower, empowering people, including clients and population groups, as well as nurses, to accomplish change, and then focusing on the community, the social system, and systems change. And then I have them look at what's their own power base. Because unless they know where their power comes from, they can't really work across interdisciplinary lines with community people and so forth. They have to learn, going back to basic civics, about the electoral process, the legislative process, the regulatory process, and the budget authority process, and the evaluation process. In other words, they need to see what happens in that whole two-year legislative cycle, how things work, and that you can't stop just because you get a bill passed or somebody elected. It's a long-term process to be involved in. And so they have to think about what they're going to be involved in. So I tell them to find an issue that they're passionate about, look for an opportunity for change, select their strategies, and move. Want to discuss how educators can partner with state nurses associations in organizing a day on the Hill. In Minnesota, the Nurses Association has a long history of taking nurses, members of the association, and students to the Hill once a year during the legislative session. And this is a joint effort of their Governmental Affairs Commission, their practice staff, faculty from Minnesota colleges and universities, and members from the Student Nurses Association. I chaired the planning committee for several years, and we had a laundry list of things that we did. We met about four times a year. We were very effective. But we helped develop the program, develop the communications to faculty and students, and making recommendations for the program, networking, and evaluating the outcomes. The association provided all of the support you would expect them to, outreach, marketing, maintaining their website, news releases, developing health policy issues, developing papers for the students to use, registration, worked with legislative staff. They subsidized nursing faculty who attended, five from each college went free. District Nurses Association provided a small number of scholarships for students and mentors for students on that day. It was free to MNA members, and they did the program development. College of Nursing were asked to co-sponsor the event. Usually cost about $200, $250, and we would have a booth at the event. We would go with our students, make a commitment to integrate the content into the curriculum, because if it's not a required activity, students don't go. And to subsidize, we would subsidize student attendance frequently. Okay, what did students do that helped them transform from bedside nurses or public health nursing students to transformational leaders? This is a picture from, I think it was last year's M&A on the Hill. The students are carrying signs that were made with the theme of the event, wore t-shirts. They were encouraged to make their own posters and signs and to get involved before the event. Meeting with nursing leaders, nurse legislators, finding out about the issues, I thought I'd throw a picture of Linda in there, was important for them to understand how nurses already were, and especially in public health, were taking the lead in dealing with population health issues. Getting involved in their with their community assessment project and other activities to look at health issues in the community that needed attention. On the right, you see students in the foot care clinic that I helped to develop at a homeless shelter. That in itself was a very transformative experience, actually seeing people who were just like them or their grandparents or their parents who were homeless and needed help. Student participation, they had a lot of curricular activities they're involved in, and I'll talk about a few of those. They had to select a health policy topic. Frequently it was one from one of the planks of the Minnesota Nurses Association, but if they felt strongly about something, they could take a different issue. I remember having a woman whose daughter was mentally retarded, and she wanted to take some actions and talk to her legislators about a funding bill that would provide help for her and her family and her daughter, and that was fine. We would, in the classroom, engage them in structured controversy assignments and activities, investigating the political landscape to see what's going on, reviewing the website, using the online toolbox that I developed, making posters and signs. They had to identify their own state legislatures, which when they had to figure out how to figure out what district they lived in, and we were talking House, Senate, national, state, whatever, arrange meetings with their legislators, register for the event online, prepare a 1-minute talk. I told them they would have 30 seconds to 1 minute, if they were lucky, to get their point across and to tell stories. Stories are more effective than data. And some of them would write letters, and then how were they going to dress? Because they had to present themselves as professionals. They should not wear jeans with holes in the knees or plunging neckline tops and so forth. Active participation then, they had a morning, a few hours, where they would hear a keynote speaker, they would get oriented to the process, find out about the political planks, get information to share with their legislators, link up with mentors. Then they would go to the Capitol, this is in downtown St. Paul, go to the Capitol, attend a demonstration, either outside or in the rotunda. And I had one student from a country in Africa who was very, very afraid to go to the demonstration because she said where she came from, demonstrators got arrested. And I assured her it was a peaceful demonstration and that it was not an issue. Then they would visit with their legislators, might visit with other legislators involved in key health and social event services committees and attend hearings. So it was a transformative event. And what the student said was, I didn't know this many nurses would be interested. There are usually over 1,000 attendees, the majority of them students. My legislators actually listened to me. They didn't realize they were considered experts. And I guess nursing is more than going to work. They saw the great world of nursing besides their 8, 10, or 12-hour shift. And I didn't realize we could make a difference. Very transformative experience for the students, from direct care to lobbying for population health issues. So we developed a population action toolkit that could be used, files, websites, videos, things that students could access online, charting the political landscape, telling them to look at who are the key people, the movers and shakers, what's going on, what has to happen, what are future needs, what's the outcome likely to be, and how can you be involved. Participating in structured controversy, which is a good way to deal with ethical issues, and frequently we would ask them to take the position that was not theirs, which was very hard for them. And then finding common ground, compare and contrast alternating positions, theirs and someone else's, and then finding their common ground, finding the linkages where they could form coalitions or partnerships. And this is just, I'll go through it quickly, I think it's a 7-slide PowerPoint that I put online on finding common ground. My colleagues were very surprised I could do a short PowerPoint. The process of consensus building, and then coalition formation. So this would be something they would just watch online, has no audio portion. And then consultation for faculty. As part of the planning committee for the day, we decided that faculty needed a lot of resources because a lot of faculty, this was something they weren't used to doing. So when I left as chair of the committee, we were in the process of developing a lot of different pieces of information for them. Okay, and I'm done. Thank you.
As I listen to all these wonderful presentations, I'm thinking we could collate them all and have a book on how to run a successful program, from developing focus groups to inform health education materials that we might be writing, taking data to inform our practice, using community action plans and population-focused planning. Using the stages of competence for all of us to reflect on the growth areas where we really want to enhance our own performance, and using theoretical frameworks for defining our practice. And for myself, I work at the Children's Health Fund. I've been there for a couple of years. So I am a pediatric public health nurse, and I have learned so much from the fund. We've got mobile clinics across the country, in rural and urban areas, and in some frontier regions, taking care of the most underserved kids of the country. If we just provided the care, we would not have the kind of impact that we do. We have a big policy and advocacy component at the fund, and I encourage you to go to our site, childrenshealthfund.org, because of the way that they take our experience, our boots on the ground as clinicians, and transform them into meaningful points for the legislator. We go on the Hill on an annual basis. We take all of our medical directors and occasionally bring in the nurse practitioners who really give wings to the fund's mission of bringing care to the most underserved. But we take that experience and we take our data and have made a very compelling advocacy effort on behalf of kids. The other thing that I've learned at the fund, and it really ties in with so many things that you all spoke about, that human trafficking story is profound, it's overwhelming, and so sad. Nick Kristof, who's an editor with the New York Times, but also a very good friend of the fund, says, once you take that story of the human trafficking and move beyond that one individual, you lose people. So that the need for stories are critical, and try and keep it to the story of one. Again, it's been a wonderful opportunity for me to sit with these panelists and look at all the essential points that they made. I'd like to, for the next 10, 15 minutes, open this for questions. Yes, in the back.
For Claire.
It didn't because of the union environment. You know, it basically had to be negotiated out and ended up being a seniority-based system, so the more senior employees were retained. We continue with all the competencies amongst the employees that remain because the core areas are still going to be the areas that the nurses will be working in. So, you know, for example, nurses that are uncomfortable with giving immunizations will still need to continue to move along that competency, as well as integrating the population health nursing projects that go along with immunizations. So, yeah, it did, you know.
So would the unions impact nursing competencies and wanting to utilize that as far as purely seniority?
It was strictly seniority.
Comments?
I'd like to ask a question about Father Bill, or Billy Bob, Billy the old guy, whatever. How has that translated to some of the other restaurants that are of a different flavor?
The way this this DVD was made was basically to apply the concept of one story. So we took that one story, and this was basically, you know, a general story of many barbecue places. Took it. The person who acted as Bill was actually Department of Health and Environmental Control employee, and his son. And this is kind of, we got this story on so many barbecue places that we had to, you know, actually have somebody act out that story, and that's what we did. And the way we are doing it is these DVDs are distributed all over the place. The idea was to have a typical local story person sort of take ownership of the food defense practices and how we need to make progress on these new practices, even though it sounds sort of suspicious. You know, you yourself might have felt a little uncomfortable watching some of those messages, which are, you know, but these are the times we live in. And so we wanted to blend the local story with, you know, the new approaches that need to be taken to prevent untoward incidents.
We had a situation in Sacramento, California, where some of our ethnic-based restaurants were targeted on purely racist basis and planted with cockroaches and other items to try to shut down the restaurants and to impact the cultural diversity in neighborhoods. So I commend you and your work for doing this, because it's terrorism on one hand, but it's also active racism on another that needs to be defended against.
Thank you. And I may add that our hypothesis, when we started to collect data from the survey, our hypothesis was that the chain restaurants, the the corporate restaurants, which were franchisees, we thought that they may have better defensive practices than the family-owned or the mom-and-pop small restaurants here and there. We actually did a cluster analysis of all the surveys that came through, and we found that there were almost no items or no specific demographic of the restaurants that defined which were better practicing food defense practices and which were not. So it's really all over the board. And there was another hypothesis that maybe the ethnic restaurants, because of language barriers or because of whatever other things might be going on, that maybe they may be characterized by a certain profile of the practice of food defense practices. And in reality, we found that the most well-known franchised restaurants were about as bad or as good as the mom-and-pop restaurants. So really, we hope that these DVDs and stuff, which were, by the way, prepared with the help of the FDA funding and by a collaboration between the University of South Carolina and the State Department of Health and Environmental Control of South Carolina, basically, I think that it is transplantable anywhere in the U.S., but the instrument that we use, the survey that was used for a local needs assessment that is published, the survey itself is published in the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice, if you go to that journal, April issue, the entire survey is there. So you could very well use it in your local community to determine which messages you want to emphasize and which, you know, messages you don't need to emphasize given the way practices take place in your area.
I just thought of something that would be helpful in terms of these media things.
Right.
You know, we don't really often do much with the departments, those of us that teach, mm-hmm. but they have to create things, the video creators or the mm-hmm. videographers or whoever, and then the people that are in acting. I mean, you really can get cheap labor out of and do some interdisciplinary things, not just with science. I mean, you can do it with other departments.
Right. Yeah, very true. And I was really amazed as a university faculty member at how much real strong resources are there within the health departments. If you can combine a really scientific way of getting a needs assessment done and then applying that to prioritize your messages and then utilizing the talent that exists within health departments, this whole thing was produced by the health department with the help of prioritization of messages, which was achieved through our data analysis from the community. And you're right, it's just not necessarily just this one area, but there are so many areas that a fantastic job can be done to develop education messages, I think. So again, quick reminder, all the messages and the material is at the back. Those of you who are interested, please take a copy of the posters and the brochure and the DVD.
As we get ready to wind down, how many of you are a part of the public health nursing section here at APHA? I went to the business meeting yesterday morning and I didn't see you all there. You are welcome to be there. They start early and they have good coffee. Tomorrow morning, they are going to be at the Colorado Convention Room, room 704, at 6:30 in the morning. Wednesday, they will also be in room 704 at 6:30, talking about the public health nursing educational offerings for next year. As far as messaging, please know that the principals behind the public health nursing section, you can find them online, but they've helped us to focus our message in case any of us need talking points. And I don't think we do, but just in case, ensure social justice and eliminate health disparities, strengthen the public health workforce, actively engage students, and promote environmental health. And for all of us here today, thank you, panel, for inspiring us to get the job done. Thank you, everybody.